This is episode 32 of The Living Reminders with Mary and Blake.
You have a choice. Cross or jump?
Why would I jump?
Because you don't want to kill a child.
She's not a child.
Yes, she is. And if you do this, it'll change you.
None of this is real.
Friend, this is more real than it's ever been.
From Providence, Rhode Island, welcome to The Living Reminders. It's a podcast dedicated to the leftovers on HBO. We're still here, and so are you. So let's talk about International Assassin. Suddenly I'm hidden. Darkness of the dawn, and your friends are gone, and your friends won't come. So show me where you fit. So show me where you fit. Hello, everyone. I'm your host, Mary Larson.
My wife right now is dancing and lip-syncing to these words. And again, the second time in a row that you've messed up my entirely perfect line that I had planned. My name is Blake. And I'm really upset with HBO.
Oh.
I'm really upset. You want to know why?
No.
Because they didn't give me credit for being Justin Theroux's stunt body double. A little known fun fact about me. They called me up. Damon and I, we had a conversation.
Okay.
And he's like, listen, Justin's a little uncomfortable with doing, you know, the tub scene.
The bum.
And, I know you, and I know that you have no problem flaunting your masculinity. Because he admitted to me that he knew that I was, you know, the ideal perfect man.
Yeah.
Right. And
muscles on top of ribs.
Muscles on ribs and on top of more muscles. And my tongue has muscles. My eyelids have muscles, essentially. Mm. And he knew that. So they gave me a call and they said, hey, can you do this? I reluctantly didn't want to leave my wife. I didn't want to leave my kid. But
Thank you.
I said, you know, Damon, I love you. I love this show. I'm willing to sacrifice my time. I'm willing to go to Texas. And they didn't even give me credit. They actually had to digitize Theroux's face on my body. Hmm. Can you imagine that?
Yeah. Yeah, it was tough.
I'm upset. I'm a little upset. I'm not going to lie. My God, I wish I had abs like that.
I know. I don't even know what those were. I was like, does he have extra bones? Because those can't even be muscles. They look so hard, they must be bone.
That guy, I don't think he's eaten a cupcake in about 15 years.
Makes me not want to eat cupcakes.
Oh, my God.
And then I remember how delicious they are, and I'm like, never mind.
And I say, screw it.
I'll just watch Justin Theroux be amazing.
Oh, my word. What an episode.
Yeah, well, what was your rating?
I've been going back and forth on this.
Out of
5 Damons, I've been going back and forth, and I'm going to call it 4.9 Damons.
You win this 4.9.
I'm still, you know what? I really, really enjoyed this episode. I really did. As much as Lens.
Okay.
Nearly a perfect episode.
Okay.
Again. And also, almost as much as a most powerful adversary.
Okay.
I still think that was probably my most favorite episode, but this one, ooh, man, this was close. How about you, my love?
I'm giving it 5.
5 up, straight
up. I'm going there. Yes.
How come? Why are you giving it 5?
I had so much fun.
In what way?
It was like, oh gosh, it was like The Matrix meets The Leftovers meets...
Jason Bourne
meets listening to church music, which is some of the most beautiful music ever. You know, it's I just had a lot of fun. I had a lot of fun watching this. I had a lot of fun knowing what's real, what's not real. I loved the ending. I loved everything. Mm-hmm. I had a really fun time. I freaking loved that hair came back.
Mom hair.
Mom hair.
Yeah, yeah.
You Gladys. Said
yeah,
Gladys. You know why I called her hair? This is going to be a little thing. Okay. So in band, I was in marching band. There was a girl that actually looked like Gladys and had hair just like Gladys. This is why I named Gladys mom hair. Because I knew a girl that was like in college and had hair like that. And we just called her hair. But she was cool with it because everyone in band has a nickname. So it's not like bullying. I was Bubza.
Nerd.
I know.
What is Bubza?
It's because I was trying to say Bubba, but I like slurred. I got nervous under pressure, so they named me Bubza. That was my name for my band friends, what, Bubza.
What the heck? You know what? I'm just going to do it. Maryism.
Little did you know. Oh. Yeah, so I give it a 5. Wow, I'm getting like 2 Maryisms.
Two. You
this
like
is
that,
amazing.
Huh?
And we had other people weigh in on what their Damon ratings were.
Pat Kennedy on Facebook chimes in and says, am I the only one who was disappointed? I think the show has taken a left turn into silly town, and I don't care if it is at all based on Dante's Inferno. Does that really make for good television? Are we so afraid of seeming unintellectual that we cannot admit that this just wasn't a good episode? Huh. You know, I'm not afraid to admit that I didn't fully grasp every single amount of this episode. I didn't get everything, although with this episode of this podcast, uh-huh. I'm going to nerd out in a major way. I am really going down the rabbit hole here with this episode.
Go for it.
So I understand and I respect where you're coming from, Pat, but I disagree that it's not that we are afraid to be unintellectual. It was something that it's like looking at the sun. You can't help but look at it, and you cannot grasp the sun's power. There's just no human way to grasp it, but you still are in awe of mm-hmm. it. And that is what I think that this episode is. David E. on Twitter says, I'm giving it 3.7 Damons. Wow, you see, now that's even more nuanced than my rating. Good symbolism, couple of good laughs, old faces, clues about Jardin, but it lacked emotionally, in my opinion. Kelly Madsen Lutomsky on Facebook says, I give it a 5. Loved that it reminded me of the Flash sideways from Lost. And she had the quote, but I'm going to play it anyway.
We have to go back, Kate.
And Tammy Smith on Twitter says, I give the episode full 5 Damons. One for Nick Cuse, one for Chatty Gladys, and a Patty Levin pushed into a well. Absolutely awesome. I will say that from what I have seen, the response from most of the viewers has been overwhelmingly positive.
Oh, I've seen mixed.
Really? In what regard?
People were just like, what the hell was that?
Okay. It's a risk.
It is a huge risk, and with only a couple of episodes left mm-hmm. and a lot of strings that need to be tied, mm-hmm. I can appreciate.
It's certainly a risk because it's putting you solely into the psyche of Kevin Garvey. Mm-hmm. And that is it. Now, how much does that story serve the overall or arcing story? My thesis for today is that it serves it in a big way. It serves it in a huge way. And I will get to that when we get there. But for now, my darling, we have some announcements to make. Well, really, it's only one announcement. Do you want to know what it is, my love?
I already know what it is.
For those of you who stuck around in the last episode, we had a major, major, huge announcement. And that announcement was that the megacast, the one that we had last year with the Guilty Remnant, has been canceled for this year. It has been canceled. Only because now we are having an UltraCast. Do you want to know what the UltraCast is, my darling?
Yes.
The UltraCast is a podcast that will happen at the end of this season. It will include us, the Living Reminders. It will also have the Guilty Remnant. We will join forces for one episode. In addition to the world famous, more award winning than our podcast ourselves, the Jay and Jack episode podcast that they do, The Leftovers. All three podcasts, Jan Jack, Guilty Remnant, Us, Living Reminders, will get together for one giant episode at the end to discuss all things The Leftovers, including the finale. And the best part is that it will all be listener-driven. Every single thing that we talk about will be a question from you guys, either on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram or smoke signals or emails or voicemails on our voicemail line. We will play it all. We will answer all of your questions. All three of us are getting together to have this one giant, fun, fantastic, unbelievably Tony Award-winning episode. And it's going to be a great time. We had a lot of fun last year. If you get a chance, go back to listen to the megacast of last year. And it will pretty much be the same, but just adding the fantasticness that is Jay and Jack. So anytime that you have a question for either of us, please, whether it's on Facebook or Twitter, just hashtag UltraCast. UltraCast. Wow, that was pretty good. UltraCast. Hashtag UltraCast. And if you are leaving a voicemail for the UltraCast, just make sure at the beginning of the voicemail that you say, this is for the UltraCast, and we will certainly play it on that particular episode. My love, how excited are you for this particular episode?
I am so excited.
It's going to be great. All of us, we get together. We can nerd out together.
That's all I want to do all day. All freaking day. Well, it is now time to figure out that title.
Let's play Figure Out That Title.
All right, kiddo. What do you got?
International Assassin, once again, this season has the easiest titles known to man. Kevin Harvey, Garvey,
you know,
was an international assassin in this episode.
Yes, he was.
Do you need to go any deeper than this?
No, I don't think so.
I don't think so either.
I think you nailed it.
I think so too.
I think we're just ready to reheat the leftovers. What do you think?
Go for it.
It's time to reheat the leftovers.
All right, kiddo, I want to point out in the beginning, before we start any of this particular episode, a few things, if you don't mind. Will you allow me to do that?
Yes.
First of all, this was written by Damon Lindelof and by one Nick Cuse. Now, you don't know who Nick Cuse is. You're not supposed to, because this is actually his first writing credit of his career. I looked it up on IMDb. I just made sure. You want to know who Nick Cuse is?
Yes.
He is the son of Carlton Cuse.
Knew I knew that name.
I know you know that name because Carlton Cuse is the co-showrunner of one famous little show on ABC called Lost. And that was Damon's partner. So how fantastic is it that Damon is now working with Carlton's son? I think it's almost poetic in a lot of different ways. Mm-hmm. In fact, working with Carlton's son in an episode that most resembled Lost in a lot of different ways.
You're a wizard, Harry.
Ho! Wrong sound.
You have to go back.
I'm like, nope.
There we go. So this was also directed by Craig Zobel, who did the episode Lens, the one that we all loved. And if you go back to the Lens episode, you will find out that we talked about all of his different movies, including Compliance and Z for Zachariah, a supremely talented director. I think second only to Mimi Leader within this show. But I wanted to start this episode with an email that I received. And I know this is not the listener feedback episode. But I got this email from Jordan Zikafus. And if I got your name wrong, Jordan, I apologize. You are an Ultra fan and I love you.
That is quite a last name,
that
though,
is
Jordan.
An amazing. What is that? It ain't Irish, I'll tell you that. Anyway, Jordan says, wow, all I can say is this episode, International Assassin, totally just kicked me in the gut. It's funny because the things I did not want to happen, of course, happened. I have fought so hard throughout this series to commit myself to the reality train camp that the supernatural magic shit was not reality and therefore was not important. Finally, after this episode, I was put in my place as the unknown is inevitable. I'm finally recognizing that it was not really important whether or not supernatural occurrences take place or exist. What is important is how the characters react and are affected by every event, whether it be supernatural or not. I find that this is what is so absolutely brilliant and, of course, pulls at my heart each and every episode about this show. I wanted so desperately for this show to be about the human condition and relationships and emotion, and I couldn't fit magic into this equation. Apparently, it took me up until this episode to realize that even when the supernatural is involved, the core of this show is the human condition, personal struggles, emotion, and relationships. I guess I just don't want people to get wrapped up in the supernatural aspect without realizing this, that the magic, the supernatural, is just a conduit for the relationships and experiences of the characters to be seen by the viewer. Mm. I don't think I've ever been so emotionally attached to a character or television series that as I am with The Leftovers. This is brilliant TV. Thank you to The Leftovers community. Yada, yada, yada. Thank you, Damon Lindelof, and the whole team involved with the series. Thank you for making television that matters, that creates a space for important dialogue about love, loss, fear, guilt, and what it is to be human. Hmm. Now, Jordan, I don't read this because you wrote it so well and it is well thought out. I read it because what you're writing, I think you don't even have the intent of what you even mean, as a matter of fact. What I mean by that is what you've written here is that the story is the story. It doesn't matter if it's real. It doesn't matter if it's magic. It doesn't matter if Kevin died or if he was just in a dream state. It doesn't matter that it is apparently to us, maybe he's in purgatory. What matters is that Kevin thinks it's real.
Yes.
Whether it's supernatural or not. If he's just a psychotic, it's real to him. And that is why I played the clip at the beginning of this episode. No matter what, it is real to him. And the story dictates where it goes. The story is what it is. And as I was reading this, I thought about Inception. I thought about Inception because, do you remember at the end of the movie, spoiler alert, the totem that Leo has, he spins it. At the very end of the movie, it kind of shakes a little bit, and then it cuts to black.
But he doesn't care. He doesn't care.
It cuts to black. What matters at that very moment is that the story, it doesn't matter to the story if Leo cares or doesn't care. He is now fulfilled.
Oh.
The story...
I didn't get that.
What matters is the fact that we went through the experience of what it was to be in Leo's shoes. We went through the experience of what it was to be in Kevin's shoes. Whether or not it is real or magic, Patty was his nemesis. But more importantly, the episode begins with Kevin. It begins with Kevin coming out of the tub, seeing himself in that weird sense in the bathroom and that weird sense of deja vu almost. Have I been here before? I don't know. But what does happen is that Kevin finds himself. And that is what is important to this story. It doesn't matter. Everyone is arguing about whether or not this is real or magic or whatever. It doesn't matter. What matters is what happens to Kevin. And that is why this episode is so important to the overall spectrum of this show, because from now on, Kevin is a different character. Kevin is something other. Do you remember last episode we had that, we didn't have the conversation, but somebody had a conversation with Patty about whether or not Lori could tell Kevin if this was a psychotic break. She refused to accept the idea that this was something other. And now Kevin is that other, and he has forever changed. He's become something that he can't even really quantify. He can't even really fully accept. But he has to, and he does. And that is his final cathartic moment in the final beat of this episode. He is the protagonist, and yet he is the antagonist all at the same time. The show makes you think that it's Patty, because he's fighting Patty,
mm-hmm.
but he's fighting himself. He's fighting his true self. And we'll get into this a little bit more as this episode goes along. But I want you to understand, you, the listener, in my opinion, it doesn't matter if this was real. We should stop fighting about that. We should stop arguing or trying to make a case of whether or not this is what it was or it was that or it was this. It doesn't matter. What matters is that Kevin thinks it's real and he has to battle whatever it is within him. That ultimately is what I want you to look at and listen to within the context of this particular podcast episode. My love, I will turn the reins over to you because now I've had about a 5-minute diatribe and everyone's probably asleep by now. And I told you I was going to nerd out and I'm going to continue to nerd out.
That's okay.
Okay, go on.
Are we ready to really reheat?
Yes, I'm want me to play the sound again?
Yes.
Okay.
It's time to reheat the leftovers.
I feel like I need to play some music. I need to be playing this. This may sound familiar.
It should sound familiar.
Because the chorus of the Hebrew Slaves played like the entire episode.
None of it was Max Richter.
Some of
At the very end it was Max Richter.
Some of this was Max Richter. When Kevin actually was talking with Patty at the well.
Okay.
That was Max Richter. Aside from that, you heard the chorus of Hebrew Slaves, which you will hear in the background for the next 9 minutes or so.
Wait, we're just going to play it the entire time, right, yet?
You know, I'm pretty theatrical. You can't blame me.
I told you, you don't pull punches anymore.
No, of course not. So, this music is something that they played throughout the entire episode. I've been trying to find, like, reasons for it. I don't really know. It's by Verdi.
Yep.
And the lyrics, fly, thought on wings of gold, blah, 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 greet the banks of the Jordan and Zion's Temple Towers. There's things in these lyrics that you could pull a little bit.
Sure.
Are the wings about birds?
Yep.
Is Jordan supposed to be like Jardin? I don't even really know.
Oh,
I don't know.
That's quite the good comparison. I will say this. Verdi, this is the chorus of the Hebrew Slaves, and it did play throughout the episode in key moments, actually, as a matter of fact. Each time I feel like the story was moving forward. This played in the beginning when the fire alarms went off. This played as Kevin was picking up Patty and bringing her to the well. This played as he was getting involved with Patty as he was meeting with her in the bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, this is what I have found out. Verdi has also made an appearance,
yes,
in The Leftovers before, and he made an appearance at the absolute very beginning of The Leftovers when the cave woman.
People were clapping.
When the cave woman gave birth. And that song that was played was the overture of La Traviata. And while doesn't really make sense, the word, it what it does make sense is that the woman, that La Traviata means the lost woman. And now we have this repeating verse of the Chorus of the Hebrew Slaves by Verdi. It's repeating. He's repeating himself. It's connecting. It has that connective tissue between this episode and then the first episode. It's legitimizing all of what happened in the first episode.
Plus, it's like really fucking serious. Listen to this. Like, that means shit's going down music. That's what that is. Max Richter is like, I don't know if I need to score this. Why don't you guys just play this awesome piece by Verdi?
Anyway, it's also known, the Chorus of the Hebrew Slaves is also known as the Va Pensiero, which means fly my thoughts in Italian. And the Chorus of the Hebrew Slaves is actually a chorus from the third act of the opera, and it was inspired by Psalm 137. Now, what is Psalm 137? As a matter of fact, it is one of the most famous psalms of all time. And it ultimately is about the Hebrews getting put out of Babylon, and some of the words exiled. Sure, there you go. Some of the words are: by the rivers of Babylon we sat and wept when we remembered Zion. There on poplars we hung our harps, for our captors asked us for songs. Our tormentors demanded songs of joy. They said, "Sing us one of the songs of Zion." But how can we sing the songs of the Lord while in a foreign land? If I forget you, Jerusalem, may my right hand forget its skill. May my tongue cling to the roof of my mouth. If I do not remember you, if I do not consider Jerusalem my highest joy, remember, Lord, what the Edomites did on the day Jerusalem fell. Tear it down, they cried. Tear it down to its foundations. Daughter Babylon, doomed to destruction. Happy is the one who repays you according to what you have done to us. Happy is the one who seizes your infants and dashes them against rocks.
Mm.
So what does this say? What is my interpretation of this is, if I forget what I'm supposed to be about, may I forget entirely. And if I don't, I'll take vengeance upon thee.
Oof.
And that, essentially, is what is happening throughout this entire episode. Kevin is discovering who he is. Kevin is discovering what he is, of what he is capable. Again, he is fighting himself. He's fighting to remember. But as we have seen throughout this entire season of The Leftovers, this season is about rebirth. Everything is about rebirth this season, whether it's going into Miracle, a mother taking a baby, Kevin dying and coming back, or perhaps making Patty into something that she wasn't. Otherwise, it is all rebirth. So in the end, obviously, Kevin is becoming something new. And that this is what this is saying. He's trying not to forget. He doesn't want to forget who he is. He has to become something other.
Okay.
No, you don't think you're going to leave me hanging on that one?
I don't know.
You know, I think what we should do, honestly, because this, I was a little intimidated by this episode.
Okay.
I was intimidated because there's a lot here to unpack.
Do you want to go scene by scene?
I think we should probably do scene by scene.
Yes.
Because
otherwise, you're going to go all over the place.
We're going to get lost in the mire, and I don't want that to happen.
Let's do this.
Oh, okay, ready? Let's do it. Let's go scene by scene.
All right. Kevin wakes up in a tubby. Tubby time.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like out in a hotel room. And I got really excited when I saw this hotel room because I said, oh, it's a hotel room he was cheating on. Lori with that Ho or whoever it was. I don't know who it was. But when he was cheating on. But no, it was not. Or at least I don't think it was. Maybe it still was the same hotel room. Nonetheless, that had nothing to do with this. Kevin, of course, wakes up and gets to pick out an outfit based upon know who you are and then adore yourself accordingly. And he had four different outfits to choose from. He had the assassin outfit, yep, which was perfect and very well
very well tailored.
Yes. There was his Mapleton police officer uniform.
Correct.
There was a Guilty Remnant outfit. Mm-hmm. And then there was another outfit that I didn't know what that was, but I kind of thought it looked like a sash that people would have if they were in a fraternity.
No.
But I don't think that's what it was.
No, that was a priest's thing that he wears around his neck. What, a stole?
Why were there like, oh, my dad has a stole.
Yes, he does.
Why were there Greek letters on it?
I don't think it was Greek.
Oh.
I'm not sure. I have to take a look again, but I don't think that it was Greek.
But so it was a religious thing, Guilty Remnant, black and white, or his police officer outfit. And he chose to wear, you know, just a simple black and white.
And so he sees himself as nothing more than just a simple black and white uniform. This is important because he no longer sees himself as a chief of police.
Yeah, because he's not.
But he no longer, obviously he's not, but you could understand if he chose that because that is in a position of authority.
Okay.
And know who you are and then adorn yourself accordingly is actually a quote from the Greek philosopher Epictetus.
Okay.
And just, it means consider who you want to be and consider who you are and then act as if you are that person. Become that person, dress as that person, but more importantly, transform yourself into that person.
I wonder what would have happened if he picked the other outfits. Just a side note, that officer outfit came back up. Before Kevin entered Patty's room, an officer was walking out, pretty much looking like the same freaking outfit with a bag over his head.
Yep. Well, you see, everybody... The outfits that were in the closet had reappeared throughout the entire episode.
Wait, was the priest robe the guy that was in the elevator?
Yes, and he was crying.
Oh, I'm so sad.
And then you obviously see the guilty remnant.
Yeah.
Okay, and then you see the police outfit as Kevin is walking to meet. Oh, I'm sorry, when he's going to the interrogation.
Yes.
You see the police officer with a bagged head. So it makes you wonder how many times Kevin has gone through this. It's like The Matrix.
Yes.
Now, is that possible? I don't know. But is this purgatory? Again, I don't know. But somebody had picked that outfit, and you did not see who that person was. Had Kevin gone through this multiple times? That's a question. That's a very good question.
It's really cool.
And the assassin's outfit is one, again, you see transformations throughout this entire episode. Again, transformation, rebirth, everything coming through at all together as something new. Kevin has become something other, and I've said this a bunch of times now, but did he transform himself from his early choices to his new choices? Let me dive down even further. When he becomes an assassin, somebody brings, actually Neil brings it up. He has no responsibilities, no family, no kids, no wife, no real job. He just gets to trek around the world. Is this what Kevin really wants? Does Kevin really want a family? You see his hesitation at the beginning of this season when they're adopting Lily. You see him losing his mind, just like how he lost his mind with Lori, as he's doing with Nora now. He seems hesitant to become the family man that he thinks he can be, but physically cannot do it. His father tells him at the end, and the Garveys at their best, stop bitching. It, your family, it is enough. And you're making this out to be something that it's not. And what you see here is that Kevin transforms from the international assassin, the person who does not want that, does not want that responsibility, to doing anything to get out of it, just to get back to his family. Not because it's easy, but because he simply chose to do it, even though it was full of obstacles. This episode is just, it's just brilliant. I'm sorry, continue.
Okay, so then someone sends him flowers. Who sent him flowers again?
It was his dad.
Okay, yes, his dad sent him flowers, but it was confusing because it was a get well card, but he meant go to the well, whatever. We'll approach that later.
Real quick. This episode, as we talked about with Virgil and Dante's Inferno, and one of the listeners actually at the beginning of this episode, brought it to our attention that this was in fact based on Dante's Inferno, something that I predicted a long time ago. Dante's Inferno, the canto number 4, which is the first circle of hell, mm-hmm. It actually begins like this, and I want you to tell me if this sounds familiar. A heavy thunder shattered the deep sleep in my head, so that I came to myself like someone woken by force, and standing up, I moved my eyes, now refreshed, and looked round steadily to find out what place I was in. I found myself in truth on the brink of the valley of the sad abyss that gathers the thunder of an infinite howling. It was so dark and deep and clouded that I could see nothing by staring into the depths. The poet, white of face, began, now let us descend into the blind world below. Kevin, you have this rumbling. You have him wake up in the water, and he's disoriented. He doesn't know where he is. He looks up, and he sees himself, and he tries to find out where he is. He's then approached by this other assassin that tries to kill him. And then he is eventually met forth by all the Guilty Remnant people, and they blind his eyes with Windex.
Oh, God, I hate that.
This was the beginning of his descent into hell, just like Dante's first descent into the first circle of hell.
Ugh.
Amazing, 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 simply utterly fantastic stuff. Continue, my love.
So Kevin gets flowers from his dad. His dad's trying to tell him, get to the well.
Mm-hmm.
We find that out later, but some guy tries to beat him up because he's an assassin.
Kevin Harvey.
That's what happens. Yeah, Kevin Harvey. My name's Garvey. No, you're Kevin Harvey.
What a great fight scene, by
Here
the way.
There you go. Boom, boom. It was amazing. I loved it. I was really happy to see that happen because I haven't got to see a lot of action. I like action, not going to lie.
That's my girl.
So Kevin gets downstairs. He's just really confused. At first, I was nervous that there weren't other people in this hotel.
I thought he was alone, too.
Yeah, I was like,
completely.
That is freaking scary. But then you see the little girl by the pool, mm-hmm. looking in the pool. Creepy little girl. Now we know it's Patty. Kevin finds Virgil. Virgil acts like he doesn't know who he is.
Correct.
But he does.
That's right.
He says, meet me in the garage, man.
5 minutes.
All will be explained.
Yep.
Kevin then sees that the girl is drowning.
Correct.
Saves her.
Here's the question. If that's Patty, why is Patty trying to drown herself?
No, she's not.
Sure she is. She was at the pool.
She was fucking with Kevin.
That's...
I think she was fucking with Kevin.
That's probably true, unless she had decided that she could no longer take it. But it then calls into the question, you know, Kevin saves her and revives her to life. Is that, you're right. Is that something that she wanted? Is that something that she tried to do? Because is Kevin his most vulnerable self?
Yes.
As the international assassin? Is that what he truly wants to be? Not necessarily one of fame and fortune, handing out euros to people who are going to beat him up. But is it something that he truly wants to be alone?
Oh. I don't know.
That's and it, and if that's the case, is Patty reflecting herself in this world, in this purgatory, as a little girl? Because that's what she felt like. Mm. The one that who was abused. The one who couldn't be spoken to. The one who was a fat shit.
So was she trying to kill herself? I mean, because this little girl never spoke well about herself.
Correct.
She had very low self-esteem. Mm-hmm. Good point.
And the dad comes running out. It's mind your own fucking business. Yada, yada. I told you can't swim. Why are you trying? Mm-hmm. Does that mean she just tried to swim? Or was she looking longingly into the water thinking, this is the end and I need to do it? I don't know. I'm not sure. But it is good.
It is good.
Continue.
Twice in this episode, Kevin passes by some women speaking Spanish, and mm-hmm. I feel like they never put things in there that they don't need to. Mm-hmm. But Kevin knows Spanish, so once again, I'm upset with the fact that if Kevin knows Spanish, why didn't we see subtitles?
We should at least be privy to what his knowledge is, because we are in his POV.
Yeah, and I know because he spoke Spanish in the first season.
Yes, he did.
So I did do a little Googling on this, and I guess the conversation was about a human heart. And the person said, don't tell me what you're doing. I'm not a doctor. Later, outside the hotel the second time, mm-hmm. after the fire alarm, they were saying, this is a human heart. Please let me in. I need to be inside. It's really urgent that I'm in there. Please hear me out. I have to go now. If you don't let me in, someone is going to die.
Huh. And it did have a donor. It looked like it was something like a donor box.
Yeah. So you know that was the conversation.
Yep.
But I don't know. But obviously they wrote it in there for a reason. So this is, you know, one of the first times he sees this this woman. Also, what's up with all the fire alarms going off?
That is... apparently, from what I could tell, that is something that is transference from Kevin's dad. Because remember, Kevin's dad says later on in the episode, we're in the same hotel room.
Okay.
And he's trying to speak to him through that.
Yes.
And the fire alarm keeps going off because he has the fire in the background.
Yes.
Don't put it out. I need to keep talking with him.
Okay. I was very confused.
Okay, that's why. Now, I don't know, but that's what it seems like.
Okay, so he meets up with Virgil, and Virgil basically says, Patty's your target. You've decided to become an international assassin. So because of that, she is running for president. She's going to have a ton of security. Don't drink the water. There's going to be a gun in the toilet. Just like the Godfather. Yes, just like the Godfather. And you're going to be able to meet her. So you need to kill her then. And watch out, because she's going to be thinking in spirals.
Yeah, and she's going to try to convince you that she is not she. That she is someone that is other. And I brought this, I wanted to talk about this too, because yes, this episode is certainly well-versed in Dante. It is certainly inspired by Dante Alighieri's The Divine Comedy, The Descent into Hell. And I want to explain the character of Virgil a little bit within the context of Dante, within the context of The Divine Comedy, upon which this episode was based. Virgil in The Divine Comedy, again, as we talked about, was a Roman writer, right? He was a Roman philosopher. And Virgil represents reason and wisdom within The Divine Comedy, making him the perfect guide. As the journey progresses, his treatment of Dante changes depending on the situation. Often and most importantly, Virgil is the protective of Dante, just like Virgil was of Kevin. At times, he reprimands Dante for his sympathy, reminding Dante that these damned souls are here for punishment, and that their punishment is the design of a larger plan dictated by God, meaning, she's going to try to trick you. Do not give in to her. Virgil is very careful to explain patiently all of the functions of hell and its various structures. He's also constantly solicitous of Dante's welfare, and he knows that Dante is dependent upon him, just like Kevin was dependent upon Virgil within the episode. Virgil, what am I doing here? I took the poison. I did what you told me to do. I woke up in a fucking bathtub. What are we doing here? You have to help me. At times when Virgil himself is having difficulty with some of the shades, he tells Dante to wait behind because he does not want to frighten Dante, who is completely dependent upon him as both a guide through the geography of hell in a spirit and as a spiritual guide. And finally, even in the bottom parts of hell, Virgil has to scold Dante for pitying those who deserve the punishment they are receiving. Virgil's great task is to get Dante to harden his heart against the most horribly damned shades in hell. He succeeds, and he shows Dante how to climb Lucifer's leg, and then he turns upright to see the stars of purgatory ahead of him. Meaning, Patty, in this, within the context of this story, and of course it's not a literal translation, they took artistic license with all this. Patty is in fact Lucifer in this instance.
Yes.
He is climbing her leg. He is finding out who she is. And he is finding out who he is all at the same time. And Virgil is there to guide him. But Virgil does not lead Dante to paradise. Someone else does. Virgil does not lead Dante because at the time, within the context of the story, Virgil is a pagan and he is not allowed to see paradise. He's not allowed to see God because that he is a pagan. Who leads Dante to paradise? Well, the character's name is Beatrice. And I'm going to talk about Beatrice in a little bit. But in the end, you see Virgil drink the water in the show.
You don't see it, but he tells you, I drank the water.
Correct. And he cannot guide Kevin any longer because he forgets who he is and what he's doing there. He kills the bird, right? Just like Virgil and Dante. We'll get to Beatrice in a moment, but my love, continue.
Okay. Pair of SUVs come up with the guilty remnant rolling out. We see mom hair.
Kevin, do not let them see you. That's what Virgil says to Kevin.
Mom hair, like, sees him right away. Done. You're screwed.
And what a great reveal to see her back. I was like, oh, Gladys.
So happy. Yes. Yes. So, so happy. Kevin goes back to his hotel room and he gets a new outfit. How convenient. So great. And then the fire alarm happens again. And that's when he goes out. You get to see a congratulations, it's a boy balloons.
And you don't know who that is. And he walks up to him. Is that for me? No. Is your name Mary Jameson? No. Well, then it ain't for you. So what does this say to you?
That Mary Jameson is pregnant with a boy.
Okay, but is she dead or is she other?
She's other.
And what is other to you?
Limbo.
Why is she in limbo?
Because she's in vegetative state.
That's my girl. A lot of people are saying that she is dead. And in fact, I do not think that she is dead.
Nope.
She is in limbo. She is the way she is in real life. Because she is in the vegetative state, because she is in limbo in this spiritual world.
Yep.
Continue.
I'm glad we're on the same approach as that.
That's my girl.
So Kevin then gets, you know, jumped pretty much by a GR.
Correct.
And they say, we have to vet you and make sure that you tell the truth because there's been some, you know, talk that someone's going to try to kill Patty. And he's like, oh, shoot. So he gets stuck to a lie detector machine, and they ask him what his name is, and he already Fs up because he says Kevin Harvey, and obviously it's wrong, so he says Kevin Garvey. And he has to play along with this. And I loved it because then when they asked him if he wanted a drink of water, and he was like, oh, no, I'm not thirsty, and it showed up that he lied. But somehow they were cool with him.
Correct.
With all of his answers.
But why does he smoke? And he says, I'm addicted to nicotine. And the light comes on. What a great scene, by the way.
Oh, my God, I loved this.
The light comes on, and he says, no, and he gets the Windex in his eyes. Again, calling back to the fourth canto, the beginning of the Circle of Hell for Dante. Now let us descend into the blind world below. Again, remember, he was blinded by the Windex at the hands of a white face in Gladys.
Oh my God.
Isn't that really cool?
Yeah. Well, I just thought it was crazy that he said he smokes to remember that the world ended. That's why the GR does it. So, Kevin, are you kind of aligned with the GR?
More on this later. More on this later.
Okay, now why shouldn't he drink the water? Because you're going to forget everything.
Correct.
You're going to become one of these weird, live in this dream world matrix people.
Wow, man, you are bringing it today with the matrix stuff.
You're
part of the matrix if you drink the water. I really like that. That's very good.
Don't drink the water.
Oh, by the way.
Cloud in the water.
By the way, I just wanted to play this for you.
Bam! Just like that. A winner!
You were very right about Patty possibly being a Horcrux. And you were also very right about the King's Cross type deal. I was the one who said, there's no way they're going to show Kevin and Patty battle it out in the Netherworlds with the swords and the fire and brimstone. And while I was not entirely wrong, I certainly was not right either. And you, my love, were right. And I just wanted to give you credit for that.
Thank you.
All right, continue.
Kevin gets to meet Patty. Passes by that weird cop. Who are you? I don't know. I got to take a bathroom break if you don't mind. Holy shit, it's Wayne.
Yes, holy shit indeed, because Wayne is on the toilet.
That's what I meant. That was like, you know.
That's why I said booby trap.
What is Wayne doing there?
And why is Wayne drinking the water? And why is he saying, why is he so...
Why is he on Team Patty?
Why is he on Team Patty?
Why is he literally Patty's bodyguard?
Now, is it something that... Yes, so we can now at least officially say that Wayne, at least within the context of the story, is officially dead.
Yes.
He is not David Burton. He is in limbo, and he is in Patty's... He's under Patty's restraints. Now, is this... Again, here's... You know what? I'm not even going to entertain the idea of it being real or not real. I'm just going to say, is it possible that Wayne was a fake? Is it possible that he is there because he did not have the powers that he claimed he did? Mm-hmm. And that is why he is susceptible to Patty's antics. And that is why he is the head of security and will at upon command shoot Kevin Harvey and the motherfucker in the face.
I do not know.
And the deja vu happens. He says, I remember. I think I've met you before.
I think I was sitting on a toilet the last time I met you before.
And Kevin Harvey thinks straight. And he says, he thinks fast and says, no, I couldn't tell you. And because Wayne has forgotten who he was and what he does and what he did, he can't quite remember but recall a slight moment in time and ascribe meaning to it.
You cannot trust the mind, for it will play tricks on you.
Yes, that's correct. And
says
it did.
Wayne.
It did.
So Kevin gets to sit down with Patty, and guess what? Patty doesn't drink the water.
No, she does not. Doesn't touch the stuff.
Nope. Patty looks very pretty.
She does. Very nice.
Look at you. I loved her glasses. I need to find those glasses. I've been looking on like Warby Parker and stuff because those are the kind of glasses I want. I want them so they're like halfway in the bottom. Anyway.
Well, you know what? Before we move on, let's talk about that water.
Oh, okay. I thought you were going to talk about the glasses. And I was like, really? I don't think we have to have this conversation right now.
Let's talk about the water. What about that water? Well, Virgil writes about that water in the Aeneid. The first work that the Roman philosopher writes about this water. And he talks about the river Lethe in Greek mythology.
Makes you forget.
It was one of the five rivers of the underworld of Hades. Hades being what we would consider to be hell. Also known as the aimless Patmos, the river of unmindfulness, the Lethe followed around the cave of Hypnos and through the underworld, where all those who drank from it experienced complete forgetfulness. Lethe was also the name of a Greek spirit of forgetfulness and oblivion, with whom the river was often identified. In classical Greek, the word Lethe literally means oblivion, forgetfulness, or concealment. It is related to the Greek word for truth, which is Althea, which through the private alpha literally means unforgetfulness or unconcealment. So, the shades of the dead were required to drink the waters of the Lethe in order to forget their earthly life. In the Aeneid, Virgil writes that it's only when the dead have had their memories erased by the Lethe that they may be reincarnated as something else. So, again, it goes back to Virgil and taking the water, becoming something else, transforming yourself and reincarnating yourself, forgetting who you are. Here's the funny thing. Patty, well, the stand-in for Patty, says, I don't touch the stuff. And she does not take a drink of water. She retains who she is. And she says, I'm from Lowell, Massachusetts. By the way, Ann Dowd, girl, I love you. You are a straight Massachusetts girl. And you rocked that accent. You brought that back. I'm so proud of you.
Me too.
What a great turn, right?
Yes.
Oh, it felt like home. So proud of her.
Let's talk about the stand-in. Oh.
By the way, how about the inside joke when he gets patted down when he meets
Jesus.
Patty? Well, no.
Oh,
congratulations. Mary's like,
what does that mean?
Why did he say congratulations? I'm like, because he's hung like a freaking porpoise. That's why. And it goes back to the jogging pants.
Yes. Very distracting. I will say it again. Very yes. distracting. So can we talk a little bit about Kevin's discussions with Patty?
Yes, please. Let's do it.
Patty asks Kevin, why do you want to vote for me? Why do you care?
Mm-hmm.
What do you think is my my big thing? What do you think is my big deal?
You want to destroy families. And that's what it boils down to for her. She is incapable of relationships. She is incapable of having any kind of attachment to anybody. Yet, she's attached to Kevin. She can't destroy him. She can't get rid of him. It's out of her control. But everything else is within her control. And the guilty remnant believe this very thing. So, in a way, she says to Kevin, our cave collapsed, Kevin. Now we can spend all of our time digging through the rumble and looking for signs of life, or we can transform. You can be something other.
Hello, callback to the first episode of Weirdness that nobody understood either.
Now, in the end of the episode, we see Kevin dig himself out of his shallow grave. We see him become something else. He transformed. What did he transform into? And that is why this episode is about Kevin. And if you care about character at all, you want this story to be told because it now alters the trajectory of the leftovers to begin with. Is Patty what the main goal is? Is killing Patty the entire plan? Is this what it's all about? Is this what he is going after? As Hannibal Lecter would say, no, that is incidental. The main idea is that he is transforming himself into what he can and should be for the remainder of the story. And that is why he is the antagonist and the protagonist. He is fighting himself, and that is why he was never going to stay dead. He was never, ever going to stay dead because his story is not complete. It is an unfinished work. Continue.
Thank you.
Sorry.
So Kevin goes to the bathroom, gets a gun, shoots Wayne, shoots Gladys, shoots Patty after she's like, I'm not Patty, I'm a body decoy, and he still says goodbye, Patty. Because whatever. He was thinking you were playing a joke on me. That's what Virgil told me you were going to do. Shoots her. Beautiful. Music happens. But then you know what happens?
What?
Nothing. Kevin is still there. Right. That wasn't the real Patty.
Nope.
What the hell is going on? Goes downstairs, says, Virgil, what is going on? Virgil kills a freaking bird
that he
said don't kill.
After he said in earlier, I hope they don't get that bird.
Yes.
Now, okay, here, let's tackle this real quick. The bird being inside this purgatory.
Yes.
This is not good news.
Why?
This is not good news because
the bird is dead.
The bird is dead, and it's representing the fact that there may not be the magic left in Miracle.
Jordan? Okay.
In Miracle. Something is awry. But here's the more important thing. Virgil can no longer lead Kevin.
Because
he drank the water. He forgot. But, my love, who does lead Kevin to the right thing?
His dad.
And this is when it comes back to the character of Beatrice in the Inferno.
You keep confusing me because it's like Leftovers and then it's Dante, and I get it. There are so many similarities. It's not a joke. This is really what Damon was going after.
Beatrice, who is she? Well, I'm positing that she is represented by Kevin's dad. Kevin's dad is the one who leads him to the idea of the well. The well is what makes him transform himself. It allows him to let go of Patty and allows him to enter paradise. It allows him to go back to life. So who is Beatrice? Well, Beatrice is one blessed in heaven. Beatrice aids Dante's journey in the Inferno by asking an angel to find Virgil and bid him guide him through hell. Now, again, this is not a literal translation from Beatrice to Kevin's dad. It's not perfect, but it makes sense. Because remember, the flowers came from Kevin's dad.
Yes.
Okay? When Kevin asks, hey, flowers were delivered to my room. Who delivered them? Everything went through the concierge. Who was the concierge?
Virgil.
It is easy to infer that Kevin's dad had a conversation with Virgil.
Okay.
And it's easy to infer that Virgil was being leading Kevin through hell at the behest of Kevin's dad.
Okay.
So Beatrice asks Virgil to guide Dante through hell. And like Dante and Virgil, Beatrice corresponds to a historical personage. In the end, Beatrice, you know, has a limited role in the Inferno, but she does become more prominent in Purgatory and Paradise, like I said. So Dante, within the story, falls in love with Beatrice, and he searches for her in Paradise and everything. And again, it's not a literal translation, like I said, but critics generally view Beatrice as an allegorical representation of spiritual love. And let me say that there is a love there between Kevin and his father.
Yes, there's a love
there. And it is now, as you can see very clearly, there is a spiritual connection between them. Kevin Sr. is contacting Kevin Jr. in this purgatory or hell type world through the TV. He is aiding him. He is guiding him. He is, granted, Virgil gave Kevin the pamphlet for the well in Jardin, but he could only go so far. It was Kevin's father who led them and led Kevin to the paradise, just like Beatrice did for Dante. Whew. That is what I'm positing.
Hey, before this whole Beatrix, before he meets his dad and finally gets, you know,
yep,
the TV reception working,
yep,
he gets to meet Neil.
What a great reveal, right?
Wow, that was amazing.
What a reveal.
Yep. You just thought he was this jerk, this bad dad. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, you hear him say, you know, I can't find a girl to take a dump on me. And you're like, oh my God, it's Neil. And Kevin says, there's not a little girl in there. And he says, no. And he calls her bad names.
And she has this thing pinned to her shirt that says, I talk too much, or I can't stop talking. Something to that effect. And sorry for those of you who are upset with me for not knowing the exact wording. I apologize. But it is, it's of the ilk of iced, I talk too much.
Which is so funny that then the guilty remnant decided to not talk at all.
Well, which eventually leads into the whole story of the Jeopardy thing that she eventually talks about, which we'll get into since we're trying to go scene by scene.
There you go. So I just wanted to make sure we got in that holy smokes, the little girl is Patty.
And he kills Neil, by the way. He kills Neil because he is doling out justice that Patty could not dole out. He is sympathetic for Patty. He empathizes with Patty. He is out of control of himself, and there's no point of return later on, but he still can't help but empathize with those people, just like Dante.
Then little Patty shows up. Hi, Kevin. Do you know where we're going? Yeah. Yep.
We're going to the well.
They go downstairs and ask Virgil, hey, concierge, do your concierging. Where's the closest well? Oh, well, there's a well in Jardin. How convenient.
Correct. And again, it calls to this idea of Jardin being the Axis Mundi. It is the place that connects the heavens and earth. And it also, for what this posits, it connects hell and earth. It is the one connective tissue through all of it.
How cool that they had this little girl, aka Patty, read this informational brochure to tell you about this little backstory of this well.
Which connects everything back to the cave woman saying that this well was created by the indigenous people, that it was created a long time ago, and that it was a spiritual thing for them, and it resides, at least from what we can see, very close to where the cave woman, in fact, died.
But I know something that's crazy.
What's that?
The car that Kevin drove, mm-hmm, to get to Jardin, mm-hmm, was the car that it looked just like the car the girls disappeared in. It wasn't Kevin's truck.
No, it was not Kevin's truck.
It was a white car, just like the one the girls disappeared
in. It was a white Mercedes car, as a matter of fact. Very astute point, my love. This is why, you know, this is why you're the host of the show, because you got that
co-host. You're full of it.
You just rock. What do you want me to tell you?
Why did he drive in that car?
Why did he have? Well, he's an international assassin.
Why is that car there?
I would expect no less from an international assassin to drive anything, but.
Are the girls there? Are the girls in this limbo world?
Ah, would that would also suggest that they have. I mean, that would suggest that they are. They brought their car with them. Number one.
Maybe they fell in the well when the earthquake happened.
Well, no.
Maybe they fell into the well.
Well, if we're to...
They were at the well area.
If we're to accept that notion, that means then that the parties that were searching for them didn't look in the well. And I find that hard to believe.
Well, maybe you can't find their bodies because their bodies are somewhere else. Like, maybe they transported.
Possible. Or, you know, there was that earthquake. Perhaps there was rubble on top of the girls.
In the well. There you go.
That's an explanation. But to suggest that they are in this purgatory because of that car, I think that's a good indicator of where they might be. If, in fact, they did depart, or if they're dead, or if they're in limbo, like Kevin is.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, who is this Jamoke that tries to stop Kevin and tells him to jump and kill himself?
Correct. Now, he was an Australian guy.
Yeah, and I was like, are you the guy? Are you 42 Wallaby Way Sydney guy that Dirty Santa was writing to?
Well, you know, the director, there was an interview that they had with Craig Zobel after the episode. And one of the questions asked of him by Variety, as a matter of fact, was, so let's talk about the turn it takes at the end and the blunt reference to Greek mythology as Kevin and Patty must cross the river Styx. And Craig Zobel says, really bluntly, with a real blunt mallet, but in a fun way. Yes, we are going to cross the bridge again. There's something in the script that said cans of fire. And I said to Damon, should we just go 100% for that idea? And he said, yes. I hope it plays and feels part of the same universe. By the end, we're doing some weird stuff in that well. So we had to have some transition, and I hope it works. So what is the River Styx? The River Styx was actually written about by guess who? Virgil.
Dante.
And the River Styx.
Wait, Virgil? What? I'm so confused. Virgil?
Virgil was the Roman philosopher.
Okay.
Okay.
Not the character. In Dante, the character in The Leftovers.
Yes. Yes, correct. Virgil.
There's too many Virgils.
Virgil the writer.
Just give him
talked
a new
about
name.
It. And this is the River Styx. It's a river that formed the boundary between Earth and the underworld, the domain often called Hades, which also is the name of its ruler. The River Styx, the Acheron, the Lethe, and the Cocytus, I'm not sure how to pronounce that. I don't know that one. All converge at the center of the underworld on a great marsh.
Which, I'm so confused.
Well, let me go forward with this, okay? I'm going to wrap it all up here. Which sometimes is also called the Styx. According to Herodotus, the River Styx originates near blah, 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 Styx, okay, so on, blah, blah, blah.
I'm just confused. I'm not going to lie, and I bet I'm not alone. I don't freaking understand.
In order for someone to go to Hades, essentially, they had to cross the River Styx. And
I watched that in the movie Hercules, Disney movie.
Correct, and there's a ferryman on the River Styx that takes people across the River Styx.
He was in the movie Hercules that Disney made as well.
Correct. And it made it to the fifth circle of hell, where the wrathful and the sullen are punished by being drowned in the muddy waters for eternity.
That was in the movie Hercules by Disney as well.
With the wrathful fighting each other. In ancient times, some believed that a placing of a coin in the mouth or the deceased would pay for the toll for the ferry to cross the river, which would lead one to the entrance of the underworld, and if someone could not pay the fee, it was said that they would never be able to cross the river, and the ritual was performed by the relatives.
So if this is just like the movie Hercules that Disney made, who are the witches who get to be the fates?
I don't know. I don't have that answer. What I'm telling you is, is that the Australian man is, in fact, the ferryman.
Okay.
And Kevin had to make a... Sorry, that was Felicity. She is not Virgil or the ferryman. That's our daughter. Kevin had to make a payment of some sort to the ferryman, and we don't know what that is because the ferryman whispers it to Kevin. I imagine that will come back up again.
Oh, yeah.
And that is why he was able to cross. He was able to cross the bridge because he is effectively crossing the paths of the Styx over the river and by the gates of hell represented by the cans of fire. He is going to Hades, the fiery existence of Hades, as he's walking past it to the final ring of hell that he must do to kill Patty. So
ring of fire.
So that is what Ow.
Sorry.
That must have hurt. Mary bumped her head into the microphone again. So that is ultimately what is probably representative of the River Styx, which would mean that Jardin in this world is hell. It is the last circle of hell.
Why do you want to go back?
As opposed
to
the miracle that we all know. And somewhere in between probably lies the truth.
Okay, now that I'm like putting it in Hercules terms, I understand a little bit more.
Okay, that's my girl.
Because you just got too much stuff going on. There's too many layers. There's 5 layers. There's rivers. There's all these people, and they share the same names as real people. I just get confused.
There's a lot here. There's a lot to unpack.
Okay, but if we just unpack to where we are right now,
okay.
You're just saying that basically Kevin's had to go through a journey through purgatory.
Correct.
And is dancing around hell and has to go to hell to get rid of Patty.
Correct. And he's also finding a way to sacrifice himself. Remember, we have that line before he meets Patty when he says, "Make like Jesus." And he spreads his arm out as though he is upon the crucifix. And he has that wound on his hand that he suffers from the would-be assassin. And trust me when I say that it looks a lot like a wound that Jesus had as he was affixed to the cross. One that is stigmata-esque. Kevin is the one who has to sacrifice himself. He loses a part of himself. Again, Patty is incidental. Everything that goes along with Patty is incidental. It is Kevin who has to lose part of himself in order to go forward. He has to be a Christ-like figure in the world that is bigger than Christ.
So little child Patty gets up on the well and says, "Do you want to drop me in or do you just want to push me in?"
Correct. And she finds all these different ways to make sure that Kevin is able to do it for her. And this is the point. This is the culmination of what Kevin is becoming. This is the point of no return for Kevin. And he knows it. And that's when he starts to cry. And he says, "It's harder than I thought. It's harder to kill someone who is actually human." When we see Patty in her way, she is not human. She is the one who doesn't talk. She is the one who steals the church. She is the one who plans Memorial Day. She is the one who says, "What the fuck was that?" She is the one who torments Kevin throughout sex and hiding the key and doing everything she can to throw Kevin off. Yet here she is as a little girl who's saying that she was beaten, thrown downstairs, abused. She's finally humanized. And it goes even further when he finally can't take it anymore, and he pushes her off that well.
That was terrible. You want to know what's even worse?
What's that?
She doesn't die.
Why won't she die? It reminded me of Austin Powers. Remember that with Will Ferrell?
And he's in
"Help, I'm really, really hurt. I'm badly, badly burnt. It hurts a lot."
Did you hear the bird, by the way?
Yes.
You hear the hawk, just like the cavewoman bird.
Yes.
Whenever something epic would happen,
that's
whether we
correct.
Don't know if it was a good thing or a bad thing,
but
meaning like the bird made that sound, the hawk made a sound right before the earthquake happened.
Correct.
And then the bird made the sound again when the new person found her and took her baby for her.
Correct. It was a Pavlovian cue that something indeed was happening. And again, it happened again for Kevin, because when he hears Patty's soft words, "Kevin, help," he can't help but again empathize with her because he realizes that she is human. And nothing goes further to do this than when she tells the story about the Jeopardy. She's saying, "All I wanted was $50,000 to get away from Neil. And I won. And I won, and I won, and I beat the guy, and it was all about geography, and I had the right answer. I beat him. I got the money. I had $65,000, plenty of money to leave Neil, yet I couldn't do it." And then Kevin has no choice but to drown her.
Ugh.
And she fights, and she says that she is scared. She's no longer the one that's in control. She is afraid to be something else. She is afraid to be other than what she is. and Kevin has to transform himself. And when she finally dies, that is when the earth erupts, the stones fall, and Kevin is now thrust back into the real world where Michael is there to greet him. Coming out of the sand and is fully transformed into what he has become. Again, it's about Kevin's transformation. It's not about Patty. It's about Kevin.
And he does. He comes out of the sand. Mm-hmm. And there's Michael Murphy.
That's correct. Waiting for him. And he says, holy shit, which I think is apropos for what happened, because something a miracle happened.
Obviously, he'd been waiting a little while. He had a little camp set up right over there.
Correct. Now, is he waiting for Kevin to come back alive?
Yes.
I'm probably going to go with that, too. Here's the thing with the whole not talking thing. Patty referenced the competitor that she was competing against, and she was saying, we were in the green room together, and he didn't say a goddamn word to me. And it was so powerful. It was intimidating. And that is why you see why she became who she became. There was a significant power in not saying a single word whatsoever.
God, you know, she's so right. She's so right. There's a person in my life who's so mean to me. Like, honest to God, is just mean to me.
In a lot of ways.
And when I'm around her, she doesn't acknowledge me. Nope. And she doesn't speak to me.
Mm-hmm.
And it hurts. And I just want her to say, I've got a problem with you, or here's something that I want to talk about, or even to be fake. She could even be fake and fake talk with me and just not acknowledge the elephant in the room that she has a problem with me.
Mm-hmm.
But instead, she just doesn't talk to me at all. And it is so bad.
And there's something powerful about that. It's
maybe
something
that's what I should do right back to her. Freaking family.
Oh, boy. Again, we have this callback to the cave collapsing. The cave collapsed for Kevin. And whether or not it is real, it was real to Kevin, as though it was as real to the woman in the cave. The cave collapsed around her people. That was real to her. It was a mythic and godlike force. And then when the earth erupts and everything happens around Kevin, Kevin is reborn. He is reborn and transformed like Jesus, who has risen from the grave and become something else. It is a godlike force, something that we cannot understand. And that is what is beautiful about The Leftovers. At least it leaves room for the supernatural. It is not like The Walking Dead. It is not like the Game of Thrones. It never lied to you. It showed you from the very beginning. It showed you from the very beginning what this show was going to be about. It was going to be about the cave. It was going to be about a cave collapsing. And it was going to be about a transformation. The woman was transformed when that snake bit her. The child was transformed when it was taken under its wing. That area was transformed because it became the Axis Mundi. It had this the pillar of smoke. It is the connective tissue. It is the Styx, as a matter of fact. It is where everything meets and collides and pools under that little bit of water where Jardin rests. Everything is there. It is the Axis Mundi. And that well is a representative of that. Kevin has come out of that well and transformed himself just like Jesus did. Really cool shit. And that is why this episode is phenomenal. It is absolutely phenomenal. It was an homage to a lot of different things. It was an homage to Twin Peaks. It was an homage to David Lynch. It was an homage to the Sopranos. If you guys are Sopranos fans, there was an episode where it was very similar in a lot of ways. With Tony Soprano, how he was in a dream state and he became a different person. He was living a life as a different person in his dream state as he was in. The hospital because he got shot. I think it was called Join the Club, I think, as a matter of fact. But it was an homage to an HBO property. But you know what it at most really was? It was a love letter. And it was a love letter to Lost.
We have to go back, Kate.
Because Lost posited that There is a place where people could meet and go forward together. It was a place where people can find out who they were. It was the flash sideways. It wasn't the flash forward. It wasn't the flash back. It was the flash sideways, where Jack, spoiler alert, can have a son. Where Sawyer was a cop. Where John Locke was a substitute teacher and he was happy with that. Where Ben Linus was a substitute teacher and he was unhappy. And like Ben Linus, Virgil has to atone for his sins. That's what he says to Kevin in The Leftovers. I have to atone. I can't go forward.
Okay.
And Ben had to atone for his sins as well.
Okay.
So it was a love letter to Lost. And as much as I love Lost, I feel like this was executed a little bit better. But ultimately, this is about character. It is about the transition of character. And that is why this episode succeeds. And that is why if you care about The Leftovers, if you care about Kevin Garvey, you need to care about this episode.
You need to care about this episode because of Evie.
Why is that?
Because I think it's going to explain a lot about where she is.
If she is, in fact...
There.
There. Okay, I got you.
Yep. In addition to Kevin. Of course it's all about Kevin, but I think it's also about Evie.
Well, my love, are you ready for the Brian David's Thought of the Week?
Yes.
All right, let's do it.
Mary and Blake, it's Brian David's from the Film Schlubs podcast. Well, we've been given yet another powerhouse episode from Damon, as well as Carlton Cuse's son, Nick, whom are now known as Damonic. I trademarked this the night of the episode, so don't get any ideas, folks. The beauty of this portmanteau is that it also applies to Patrick Somerville, co-writer of Off-Ramp and A Most Powerful Adversary. Anyway, it was so great to see Holy Wayne back on the show, as well as Gladys. Surprisingly, the episode reminded me a lot of Season 1's guest, only Kevin is a guest at the hotel in The Other Place, much like Nora was a guest at the hotel that hosted the Drop Conference in Guest. Nora's identity was taken from her in that episode since someone stole her ID badge, thus she walked around the convention as someone else, someone without an identity. In this episode, Kevin's identity isn't his either. It's that of Kevin Harvey. While there are many similarities to Guest, the obvious difference is that it's a conference for dead Leftovers characters, not debaucherous loved one salesmen or phony self-help authors. In both episodes, Kevin and Nora are in pursuit of getting their identities back, and both required hugs to make that happen. Nora encountered Holy Wayne, and that led to a hug, giving Nora her identity back. She resumed living as someone who didn't have to endure the weight of her family's loss every day. That event allowed her to move on with her life and begin to date Kevin more seriously. Similarly, for Kevin to get his identity back, he too had to hug someone, only it was Patty right before he killed her. Doing so brought him back to life, a la the Bird Box, so he could regain his identity, maybe even his sanity, and resume living as Kevin Garvey. Hopefully he can now live without Patty haunting him in the same way that Nora's departed family haunted her. More on this in a moment. As a reminder, I avoid the media echo chamber before I do these segments, but I'm sure I'm not alone in the following thought, as this episode was quite reminiscent of The Sopranos' Join the Club. Tony had a dream, to put it mildly, where he wakes up in a hotel room with a different name, occupation, and accent. Similar circumstances arise for both men and their journeys. Even the actor who played Neil, Gary Bassaraba, reminded me a great deal of Tony Soprano, or a Sopranos-like character, at the very least. I know that Damon was a big Sopranos fan, so this episode comes at no surprise. I want to talk about Virgil's atonement for a minute, as Kevin asks Virgil what he's doing in The Other Place. Virgil says, atoning. Now, one would think that he's atoning for molesting John, and while that's partially true, I think it's a bit deeper than that. I think he's atoning for molesting John because of what it did to John and the type of man that his actions created. Virgil seems like someone who loves Miracle for all its gifts and splendor, and yet his actions, by way of his adversary, at least in his words, have turned Miracle into a place that John governs with tyranny. Other gifted people like Virgil live in fear or are removed from the town entirely. Therefore, Virgil is atoning for his sins in relation to John, but also to Miracle, as it's a place that everyone should be able to enjoy. This episode was Patti's swan song as a character on the show, and what a song it was. Virgil warned Kevin how deceptive she'd be as she took on the form of her childlike self. But in her final scene in the well, you finally saw Patti for who she really was. We met the real Patti once and for all, and we learned why she'd leave her life behind for the GR. After all, she tried to leave her husband Neil for years, only to stay put like so many other women in abusive relationships. Even if we didn't already know that Neil was a philandering alcoholic, amongst other things, you could easily understand how emotionally abusive Patti and Neil's marriage was in the little time we spent with Neil. A young Patti did everything possible to get away from him, including drown herself, lock him out of their hotel room, and willingly go with Kevin to be pushed down a well. Despite being an antagonist for much of the show, Ann Dowd stripped Patti down to her core, and in her final moments, we felt sorry for her. And clearly Kevin did too as he hugged her goodbye. However, he knew what he had to do with her nonetheless. Ann Dowd, I salute you and your sensational performance. Before that, once Kevin reached the bridge to Miracle, he was given two choices by the mysterious man on the bridge, jump or cross. To cross meant that he'd go through with pushing a young Patti down the well, while jump meant that he'd have to hang himself and not bring himself back to life ultimately. The man on the bridge, played by Bill Camp, warned Kevin about the consequences of crossing versus jumping. He said, "If you do this, it'll change you." He was obviously referring to Kevin's act of bringing himself back to life by killing his adversary. Once we saw Kevin crawl out of the dirt and come back to life, all of the bird in the shoebox, this immediately reminded me of the DC comic verse, as it has something called a Lazarus pit. Once you go in the pit, whether it's to heal a wound or come back to life, you're never the same afterwards. You lose a piece of your soul in the process. Despite getting rid of Patti, I think the quote-unquote miracle pit will undoubtedly cause even more adverse effects for Kevin. He knew that getting rid of Patti would come at a price, but he was desperate to save his second family. The sad part is, he'll likely lose them again, as the crazy man will only get crazier in the seasons to come, thanks to the miracle pit. By the way, my hat's off to Justin Theroux this season. They've had him crawling in dirt as well as mud. He's jumped in pools with nice suits on. He's fallen in wells. He's dug up dead bodies. And he's even done his own laundry at a laundromat. With Evie running naked through the woods of Miracle in episode 1, does this scene take on a whole new meaning now that we saw Kevin wake up naked in the other place? Either way, whether it's a stage disappearance, which I still believe, or her own other place based battle, Evie will return to seal John's fate as Matt and Kevin open the gates to Miracle for everyone. I've said it once, I've said it 1,000 times, but this story is about opening up this town to everyone so its various gifts can save people in the ways that they need saving. Virgil's atonement involved Kevin for a reason, as he knew that Kevin and Matt would help free Miracle from his son's tyranny. By the way, such a hilarious moment when the security guard was patting Kevin down and said congratulations to him. I was quite uncomfortable watching that moment with my mom. Anyways, with Mary staying at the hotel and celebrating her son's birth in the other place, part of me is beginning to worry that a prior theory of mine, which I blogged about via the Living Reminders blog, will come true. That's the theory involving John burning down Nora's house, just like the dream sequence in Two Boats and a Helicopter, which showed Matt and a young Nora watching their childhood home burn to the ground with their parents inside, as firefighters stood around and did nothing. We saw John and his crew do the same thing to Isaac in the premiere episode, obviously. We have to assume that John won't let go of Miracle without a fight, especially when he learns of Kevin's palm print on the girl's car, as well as the potential uprising Matt is leading in the encampment. Unfortunately, the casualties in all this could very well come at Mary and her unborn child's expense, since they're powerless if the home is set ablaze by John in effort to get rid of the Garveys and Durst from Miracle. File this away just in case, but director Keith Gordon helmed Two Boats and a Helicopter, including that dream sequence with Matt and a young Nora as they watch their childhood home go up in flames with their parents inside. Guess who directs episode 209? Keith Gordon. Anyway, that's it for me this week. You can follow me, Brian Davids, on Twitter at BDF331. Also catch me on the Film Schlubs podcast and the Living Reminders blog. I expect to have a post up over the holiday break. As always, thank you to Mary and Blake and to you, the audience, for listening. In closing, I just want to say one thing. Goodbye, Patty.
Thank you, Brian. As always, it is such a pleasure to have you on our show. Love it. All right, Blake. Sudden theory of the week time. All boom, right. Go. What do you got for me?
Do you have anything first?
I do, and I'm going to leave it after you.
No.
Yes, because
no.
I never have it, and that's why I... Nope, go. Go.
You know, I wasted a lot of brain power on this episode.
Mm-hmm.
I wasted a lot of brain power. As a matter of fact, I blew off the entire day of actual work for preparation for this episode. So, what do I have? I'm going to say that Michael was there at the behest, or I will say that Michael was there waiting for Kevin because that's what he believed would happen.
Yes.
And he did it because I've been thinking about the whole epinephrine thing.
Yeah.
And I feel like Virgil did not want Michael to use the epinephrine.
I think it was fake, and he just said that to Kevin to make Kevin feel better.
Mm-hmm.
Because if Kevin didn't know that there was an escape route necessarily, he wouldn't have done it. Exactly.
I agree. But it was Kevin at his most vulnerable. So perhaps he would have accepted anything that Virgil gave him anyway. So I don't know. When I think about the actual ejecting of the epinephrine, I think it's clear that Virgil does not want it used. It's easy to infer that maybe it is real. And in fact, that Virgil thought this can't be used. If Kevin succeeds at what he does, the epinephrine won't matter because the town now has its magic back again.
Sweet.
So it was as long as Kevin did his job, he would come back to life as long as Michael provided the way for him to do it. And that is why he needed Michael there. And that is why Michael was waiting for Kevin. And I'm still maintaining the fact that the GR were going to end up in Miracle.
And, yeah.
In Miracle. I'm going to maintain that. My love, I will cede the floor to you. What do you have?
Okay, yes. They're coming to Miracle. I'm going to totally be with you on that. I think we saw some of that in the previews. Anyway, bless you, Felicity. All right, here's where I'm going. Water.
Yep.
Lots of water talk in this episode. Water is where Evie and her friend supposedly disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
People were talking about drinking water, not drinking water. They made it a point that Evie drinks the water in Jardin.
Okay.
Okay? She and her friend's playing it. Evie's gulping that stuff down when she's actually swimming in it. Mm-hmm. She's drinking it, sneaking it from her brother.
Yep.
They also had Evie and her friends running around naked. And when Kevin woke up, he was freaking naked. Beautiful, but naked. Okay? Evie and these girls have gotten to a different land.
Oh, so you're saying they're running around in the jarred land around the well in Purgatory?
Yeah.
Wow.
They're running around in Purgatory somewhere in that scene when they're running around naked.
You see, now that is an extremely valid thought. Simply, first of all, because of the naked thing, number one. But number two, it would be the reason why they showed the woods to begin with. Because if they in fact did depart, or they are just in limbo, it's telling you what it is from the beginning. It's not lying to you. It's forcing you to just come up with what you need to come up with. The show never lies.
And maybe they have to die to get there. I don't know. Maybe they have the water and that gets them there. I don't know. But all I'm saying is this episode is going to explain a lot eventually about Evie. Drinking water, being naked, things that are in common. That's my sudden theory.
Boom.
Please hang up and try again.
Final thoughts, my love? What do you got? Anything?
It was an awesome episode. I'm really sad there's so few left. I feel like there's a lot to accomplish, but I really had fun.
I'm giving it 4.9 Damons. Again, I loved it. I loved every single thing about it. It was absolutely bonkers. And only a show like The Leftovers could pull it off. Only they could pull something like this off because the show allows for the supernatural. it's not disingenuous for it to happen. It's about people struggling with the idea of the supernatural. And it may not provide answers. It may not give you the answer of where the departed went or why they went. In fact, I would even argue that the departure and where the departed are and who the departed are and why they departed is totally freaking irrelevant now. It doesn't matter. What matters is that it's gone. It is part of the story, something that you have to accept. Just the same way that you have to accept the fact that this story was told and it's not important whether or not it was supernatural or real. It doesn't matter if Laurie is right. It doesn't matter if Virgil is right. It matters that Kevin believes it's real. And that is what is most important about this episode. And if I can have you leave with one thing from this entire episode of our podcast, it's the story is the story. And it will tell you what it wants to be. And it will allow itself to be what it needs to be. And it's brilliant for that. I love it.
I just love this show. Just rent Hercules. It's on Netflix.
Just watch that.
Hercules.
You ready to close out the show?
Yep.
Let's do it.
Guys, I love chatting with you. I love hearing your theories. I love all of the excitement that you have. So keep it going. Reach out to us on Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter. Our handles are all the same. It's Living Reminders.
And if the social media ain't enough for you, you can always get us at livingreminders@gmail.com.
Head on over to thelivingreminders.com to check out previous episodes, those really cool interviews that we have, and you can get a look at our blog.
That's right. And while you're at the website, there's a button on the top right-hand corner that says support. And there are a bunch of different ways that you can support the Living Reminders, one of which is Patreon. You can donate a dollar or two a month, and we would gladly accept that. If you want to make a one-time donation to us, you can do that via PayPal. But the most important thing you can do for the Living Reminders is to tell a friend that we exist. If we provide a good enough companion for you for the leftovers, if what we do gives value to your experience, we can help dissect and analyze this show well enough for you, please tell someone that we exist and spread the love.
You can also spread the love by going to iTunes. We currently have 78 ratings.
Oh, there we go.
On iTunes. I want to keep us going, guys. Keep going. We've got a lot of great responses recently. One was by Park105. Park says, a necessary The Leftovers viewing companion.
Oh.
So thank you guys so much for those of you who have written us reviews. It makes Blake and I so happy. We like celebrate every single time. We're like, look at someone
you
actually
know what?
Cared.
You know how we had a giveaway for 70?
Yes.
I want to do another giveaway.
Okay, for what number?
85.
85. 85 is going to get a present.
85 will get a giveaway from Mary and Blake from the Mary and Blake store. Anything that your heart desires to your content.
You have to be a written review.
That's correct.
Not just giving us.
So the 85th one will get something from the Mary and Blake store. And the last thing I want you to do is go check out the Living Reminders blog. Just go to our website, livingreminders.com, hit the blog button on the top right-hand corner. You'll see all the great articles that are there, written by the fans for the fans.
As always, everyone, my name's Mary Larson.
My name's Blake.
And we're still here.